who makes the decision to donate an object? The first owner, a third, or the tenth? If an object is passed down generation to generation, or owner to donor to recipient, is it possible to find the original owner a century later? I bought a book last summer by Rudyard Kipling. You may know the name, Kipling, novelist of rousing tales like The Jungle Book, also a poet, a journalist, and short story writer. He won the Nobel Prize in 1907 at the age of 41. My Kipling book was more obscure, and there were some clues to its original owner inside. So my goal was to return this century-long due library book solely based on the contents of the first few pages.
Yeah, if you wish, you return it to the library.
What it meant was that the telegraph companies had outposts everywhere at the end of nowhere.
But in order to get there and find the family who originally owned it, I had to travel to three secondhand bookstores, a mental institution clinic, and inside the bathroom of a government corps building. All for a book with a signature and a possible swastika. No way. Is that really a swastika? Hello, and welcome to the Historical Investigative Podcast. I'm Thatcher Workhess, a collector, historian, and journalist. Every episode, we talk to an expert about an antique object and attempt to find the person who originally owned it. This is Object Obscura. Episode 19, Book, Banker, Brazil. Something that you all may not know about me is that I love paper. I am a collage artist who incessantly collects ephemera, paper scraps, and old books. I love the pictures, colors, and textures of paper in any form. It is especially rewarding to find new paper patterns in bound books, like an unexpected treasure hunt, not knowing when a loose scrap will fall out or what marks have been left by another owner. In São Luís, Brazil, I was surprised to find that old books were everywhere. Secondhand bookstores, called Sebos here in the Northeast, have thousands of antique multilingual books that I use for my collages. I have collected and used so many varying types of paper that I usually don't see anything new. This is a sebo called Passo Prosa Livraria in the historic center of the capital city. It's on the second floor of a seafood restaurant. So when I went up the tall stairs for the first time, I heard the people in the packed restaurant so close as if I was eating with them at their table. But once you're at the top in the secondhand bookstore, it's complete silence. The clanging of silverware on plates, music playing, and patrons' laughter is all diminished, as if the store pressed mute on all the activity below.
Oi, boa tarde.
Boa tarde.
I sifted through books for about an hour, until I saw something that I had never seen in an English book before. It looked like a swastika. No way. Is that really a swastika? So I bought the book and reluctantly spoke to the store owner, Silvia.
Contos do Terra e Mar.
Silvia was curious about the book and asked what the title was in Portuguese. I had no idea how to translate the title, Land and Sea Tales for Scouts and Guides. It was a red-bound short story collection by Rudyard Kipling, with 11 short stories and 7 poems. The book is not in great condition. Being exactly 100 years old, it makes sense that the spine is held together with masking tape. The cover's silhouetted images of trees and animals were barely recognizable on the muted red fabric cover. Sylvia doesn't know much about the book, but as we flip through the pages, we start to see some interesting things, the first page especially.
Nessa página aqui. Coisa mais interessante é isso, né? Qual a palavra em português para isso?
Carimbo.
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 Carimbo, né? Em inglês, que diz Western Telegraph Staff Library.
I was talking to her about the ink stamp, carimbo in Portuguese, and why it was connected to Maranhão. The stamp, located in the middle of the first page, in its entirety reads, Western Telegraph Staff Library, Maranhão Quarters. Our conversation even attracted the attention of other people in her store.
Mas é interessante porque esse diz staff, que significa em inglês pessoas que trabalham. Exatamente.
É carimbo.
A woman joins in the conversation about this ink stamp in the book. Her name is Sida, and she had a lot of useful information. However, they were both more intrigued about the handwritten words. There are four important things written in pen. There seems to be a word crossed off on the very top. Under that, Maranhão, the Brazilian state we're in, the year 1924, then in letters the size of quarters, WTC Koi, and Ilha da Água, which I thought was Water Island. Yeah, there was a lot going on. I had so many questions. What is this Western Telegraph Company? Who is WTC Koi? How did this book get to Brazil? And why is there a swastika printed on the second page?
Rudyard Kipling put this symbol, the left-facing swastika.
Oh yeah, the good luck swastika, yeah.
So just to clarify that the symbol we thought was a Nazi swastika is pre-Nazi. The man who helped me come to that conclusion is Bill Burns.
My name is Bill Burns. I'm a retired electronics engineer turned system analyst and programmer. My background is in electrical engineering originally. I worked for the BBC in London for 3 years after university and then moved to New York when I met my wife.
Mr. Burns is very knowledgeable about telegraph history and objects related to telegraphy. So when I told him about this book, he was intrigued. Why was Kipling tangled in with the story of telegraphy?
Makes sense. Yeah. So he was born in India. So
Right.
Yeah.
So Rudyard Kipling was born in British ruled India in 1865. He later moved to London in his 20s. When his short stories and novels got more popular after his father's passing, he would include the Hindi sun symbol of peace and luck. 10 years after this book was printed, the Nazi party turned the Phil-Fat symbol diagonally, using its original name from Sanskrit, swastika. So later versions of Kipling's books during the Second World War would omit the symbol.
Yeah, he would have been widely read in the British Empire, of course.
Rudyard Kipling's patriotic writing includes stories about war, imperialism, and masculinity. And he was actually familiar with telegraphy early on.
Yeah, Kipling wrote a poem called The Deep Sea Cables, kind of an allegorical poem. Yeah, published in an illustrated edition in 1909. I can see it appealing to the cable stack. You know, they're all practical people. And so I think he would have been a very popular author in that kind of situation, for sure.
So there is some connection to Kipling and telegraphy, especially with a book titled Land and Sea Tales for Scouts and Guides. But how did this book get here? It started with a British company called the Eastern Telegraph Company, branching out across the globe.
Where it starts out and there are parallel branches that come together and little side things like the Western Telegraph Company get folded in. That got absorbed a little bit later. The Eastern Telegraph Company, which by 1900 was the largest communications operation in the world.
But most companies started to realize was people needed to communicate over long distances across water.
Think, well, how can we lay a cable across the Atlantic? And they were crazy, you know, but they were the Victorians.
Most countries were just learning about electronic telegraphy systems that were spearheaded by England. But in the 1870s, other continents wanted to be involved in the global communication system. One of the most important areas at the time was the Americas. So just at the turn of the 20th century, the Eastern Telegraph Company combined already Brazilian telegraph industries into the solitary Western Telegraph Company. Thousands of miles of bicep-sized cable would be laid on the seabed to reach across the Atlantic Ocean.
But again, the idea was, though, you pick points where it's the shortest sea distance, and then you connect by a landline to civilization.
Many telegraph industries, including the Eastern and Western Telegraph Companies, laid an estimated 100,000 miles of underwater cable before the year 1900, just in the Atlantic Ocean. This isn't counting the hundreds of miles of landline cables to city centers. Specifically in South America, this was gaining popularity. Over the next 100 years, different stations were built in remote areas to receive these underwater cables to bigger cities. The idea was to reach the underwater cables to a ground station that then redistributed the messages by landline telegraph to its final destination. That's why many different offices were needed in specific locations. And San Luis, a capital city situated on the tip of an island, fit the bill for a perfect telegraph cable landing point. By the 1950s, there were 14 documented Western telegraph stations just in Brazil: São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, Florianópolis, and São Luís, to name a few. The company would actually include small roadmaps on the back of telegraph forms that showed each location in the larger South American cities. The thing is that these are the office buildings of the telegraph companies. Sometimes the cities needed farther outposts and stations.
So cables carry almost all the traffic, except where you can't get a cable to. And you put in a ground station. What it meant was that the telegraph companies had outposts everywhere, at the end of nowhere in many cases.
Essentially, these remote stations were like lighthouses, usually with a small staff on a remote building near the water. Generally, these outposts would have telegraphers, engineers, and businessmen, sometimes miles away from the city center. And a large majority of the Western Telegraph staff in South America was from England and Canada. This is where my Rudyard Kipling book fits into this story. The more remote the telegraph stations were in Latin America, the more leisure activities and objects emerged for the foreign English-speaking staff working there.
So that's 150 years of telegraph history. And right in the middle of that is your artifact, right? Almost literally in the middle of it at this point.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Burns was right. This book is in the middle of so many things, and that stamp is the piece that connects it all. We had some theories about the company in San Luis and the man who signed his name in pen, but we were just shooting in the dark. Then I had a breakthrough. I decided to go to Sylvia, the secondhand bookstore owner we visited earlier in the episode.
Voltamos.
Exatamente. Então, aqui, ó, eu achei que foi esse foi o nome dele, mas não. Esse é Western Telegraph Company.
So, I explained that the WTC COI was not a name, but an acronym. It stood for the Western Telegraph Company. The COI was a primarily British abbreviation for the word company. I felt like an idiot. That word crossed off on the top was this man's signature, though. But again, no dice on what it read. Sylvia then pointed at the large words below that read Ilha da Água.
Provavelmente da Inglaterra, né?
Sim.
Escreveu isso. Eu acho que primeiramente diz Ilha da Água, mas uma pessoa que mora aqui diz não, isso é Olho d'Água.
Olho d'Água, praia.
Sim, uma praia, bairro.
I reiterated that once again, I was wrong in encrypting this guy's handwritten scribbles. It did not read Ilha d'Água, but Olho d'Água, a neighborhood inside San Luis, about 20 minutes away. But back in 1924, when the man signed this book, it was essentially a small beach with a lighthouse. That's it. The San Luis city center faces inside the bay of San Marcos. Olho d'Água, however, is on the north side of the island with an easier vantage point for connecting underwater cables. I was still confused. Did this man live in that neighborhood? And where is the so-called library that belonged to the Western Telegraph Company? I then started chatting with Sida when she says this.
Oh.
She remembers that her mom worked at a company called Western. Her dad recalls that it was in a building in the historic center. Well, that must have been the place where this book was stamped. I asked the store owner, Sylvia, about her story and why she wanted to open this bookstore. She explained that downstairs, before the seafood restaurant opened, there used to be another secondhand bookstore. The bottom floor was for the public, and the upstairs was this guy's warehouse. But when this old owner moved out and Sylvia was interested in buying it, some of his books were still in the warehouse, where her store is located now. And this particular Kipling book was from the downstairs guy's collection. His name is Hiba. When Hiba moved to another store, she had to clean out his upstairs space and even threw some books away. But she is sure that this book was from his collection. She told me that she might have another one of his books, but after months of checking in, nothing emerged. However, she gave me the address to Hiba's secondhand bookstore. His store was closed that day in June. I did the next best thing. I followed other breadcrumbs, and Sylvia gave me the first lead. So Sylvia is talking about this building on Rua da Estrela, Star Street, with a very intriguing clock fixed to the outside. According to Sylvia and other Brazilian historians, this building on the corner used to be the office of the Western Telegraph Company. Also, Cida said that this was the building her mom worked at. It's about 3 minutes away from Sylvia's store.
One Rua da Estrela. And you can hear the streamers of the São João banners above me.
I'm walking along one of the oldest streets in the historic center.
And you look up and you see this giant metal clock on the side of the building.
On the left side is a green and white ornate metal clock jutting out of the newly renovated State Justice's Annex Court building. It's about 30 feet up from the street. It looks so European and out of place, but that is like most of the buildings in the French-founded Brazilian city. This used to be the old Western Telegraph Company office, known as the Cabo Submarino, which were the only Spanish and Portuguese words on the building at the time. There was a small plaque on the clock, but I couldn't see it from the road. I had to get in that building. This was the only physical connection of the Western Telegraph Company outside the stamp in this book. And yet, there was no museum, reference, or sign telling tourists what it represented. The Annex Court building sits on the corner of Rua da Estrela and Avenida Dom Pedro II. Something that I found out months later is that Dom Pedro II, Brazilian Empire's second and last monarch, was actually the man who signed the declaration to lay the first telegraph cables to Brazil back in the 1870s. This green clock is unlike anything I'd seen, so I went inside with the intent to ask some government workers if they knew anything about this building's history and to take a picture of the clock.
Oi, boa tarde. Oi, boa tarde.
There were two older women working behind a desk and a security guard sitting in the air-conditioned room. When I started on my inquiries, I could see that the security officer was not so happy. He informed me that I was wearing shorts and that I could only enter these government buildings with pants on. So I told him that I'd come back tomorrow at the main entrance with pants. But then the two women spoke up as I was leaving.
Tá, entendi. Tá, eu vou voltar. Tá, obrigado. Sim, Western. Sim, exatamente.
Eu não trabalhava aqui, eu era muito.
É.
Era Western.
I had not mentioned Western at all. Only that a telegraphy company was once here related to that clock. She tells me that her brother worked for the Western Telegraph Company and that she would come to this building a lot. What are the odds? It felt like she had been waiting for someone to ask her this question for a long time. I wondered how many other people in this city had some connection to the Western Telegraph Company. So the next day, I went back with more confidence and, of course, some pants. It was a blistering 88 degrees. The main courtroom building is grandiose, with colonial pillars and a detailed fresco above the staircase. But immediately inside, I was met with metal detectors. While in line, I explained to them what I was trying to do, to take a picture of this clock on their second story. So I followed one worker who was eager to help me. His name was Nildo. We crossed the small bridge connecting the buildings and spilled out of a cramped elevator. And there, from a window on the staircase, I saw the clock. Nildo attempted to open the window nearly a yard away from the clock. I took some pictures with my phone, which you can all see on our social media and our website. Its ornate bracket onto the building is green, but the clock's face is bright white. It's definitely been taken care of recently. The problem was that this plaque on the clock was facing away from us, but Nildo was determined. We go up one more floor into an office of accountants and into the bathroom. This window had the closest view to the clock. It was at this moment, standing in the bathroom of an annex court building, that I thought about the Rudyard Kipling book in my backpack. This building, whether or not it had the same interiors, was originally the Western Telegraph Office Building in 1927, almost a century ago. This was a time when the clock was working, and the company's workers had time to read books in English. But that side of this telegraph history is stagnant and secretive. In 1929, the Eastern and Western Telegraph Companies merged into Cable and Wireless, which still exists today. However, most people still referred to these telegraph companies with their original names up until the 1970s. I believe the San Luis government bought the Western Telegraph Office, the one with the clock, in the early 1960s. I hired a photographer to take a picture of the plaque on the clock, and it read, "Made by Gillett and Johnston, Croydon, 1911. This UK-based clock and watch manufacturer is still going today, and these projecting street clocks were all the rage for new form businesses because it would show the Greenwich Mean Time in these South American cities. The Western Telegraph Company had these clocks specially made for each of these 14 offices in Brazil, and possibly all of South America. The only ones left for the public viewing that I could find were in Florianópolis and San Luis. I asked a friend who lived in Florianópolis in southern Brazil if she had ever heard of the clock before. She said that she sees it every week. She took a picture of the pristine giant face, and it had the same inscription on the plaque. Accompanying this clock was a metal sign below with the Western Telegraph Company's history. Bill Burns had never heard of these clocks before. They were not something made for any office building in the Eastern Telegraph Company. For reference, I traveled to one of the other Western buildings in Belang, just north of San Luis, and told Mr. Burns about what I saw. This building in 1935 had the Western Telegraph in Cabo Submarino decals, but nowadays it has nothing, no words or clock.
The one in Belang, so in Pará, the state above, and the building looks the exact same. It's just the bottom floor is now a store.
Because Belém would have been one of the stations on the same line. When that line was put in, they would have built, the station would have all been pretty well identical all down the line, because they're all fitted out within a few months of each other, at most, you know.
This made total sense and even fit into the library theory and the connection to my stamp.
Why did the Telegraph Company have a library, for example? Because right. The stamp on the book is the Western Telegraph Company staff library. Okay, this is the thing. I don't think I've ever seen a book with a stamp on it like the one you have. Okay, so this is unusual.
But primary sources of references to technical and leisure libraries in remote telegraph stations aren't out of the ordinary.
And so I think most of the stations would have had at least a small library. Whether they needed to stamp their name in them, I don't know. But they weren't really formal libraries. Now, there's been very little written about the libraries. We know they had them, but it's not like anybody wrote a history of how the library system worked or how it was stopped.
Well, that is where I come in. This episode attempts to shine a light on something that hasn't been discussed before. One of the only other detailed accounts of a staff member in a telegraph station was in Ireland in the 1880s, in which there was an extensive library built. Who signed this book, and what is the connection to the stamp?
But with Kipling books in Brazil, as you say, not a thing there. It would have to be somebody with a UK connection. And the most likely thing is something to do with the cable station, because as it said in the note at the archive, a whole bunch of contributions from cable-related people on who that list was that Serby family. So I suspect they had some connection. Now, it's unfortunate that name's not in the Porth Corner records.
So Mr. Burns is talking about the name signed on the top of the book, which he feels certain about is Serby, possibly a man named Archibald Serby, who from my Ancestry.com deep dive had visited Brazil in the 1920s for business. So we went to the Porth Corner online archives. Porth Corner was a very remote telegraph station in the UK that today is a museum with the largest database for the Eastern and Western Telegraph Company archives. They have a digitized list of all 8,300 employed personnel who worked there from the 1850s to the 1950s. But Serby's name was nowhere on that list. So I went back to investigating on the streets of San Luis. I followed up with Sylvia about the address of Heba's secondhand bookstore. This was the last owner of this book before me and Sylvia. He had to know something. I walked to his Sebo close by, and he wasn't there that day. The guy working there told me that his house was just up the road, so he closed the shop and walked for about 10 minutes until we got to Heba's house, which was also another secondhand bookstore. Heba was a little hesitant when I showed him the Kipling book that led me to him. He knew Sylvia, but didn't recall how this particular book got into her hands. He did remember how it got into his. A man named Bernardo Tajada, a collector and cinema owner who lived down the street. In the 1960s, the story went, he had the largest collection of non-Portuguese language vintage books in French, English, and in Italian. One section of his collection, according to Heba, was English Rudyard Kipling books from the Western Telegraph Company. Heba said that he had some other books from Bernardo, and apparently Bernardo made his own stamp for each one of his books with his name, so it was very easy to tell which books were in his collection. Heba came back with a newly bound novel called Rewards and Fairies, also written by Rudyard Kipling. This 1910 book had his stamp as well. It was from the Western Telegraph Company. The case was now broken wide open. I bought the book and thanked Heba. This second book has a handwritten note stating that it was a part of the Madeira Staff Library in 1910, another telegraph station on the Portuguese island. On the very bottom was a square blue stamp that read WTC Mess Library, Olho da Água. On my way back home, I stopped by Silvia Sebo to share all of the news about the stamp and the developments in this mystery. She told me about Bernardo and his legacy in San Luis, that he was a very traditional businessman. But it totally made sense that he would have had one, if not both, of these books. I'm not sure how much value Bernardo saw in these Kipling novels. There is no intrinsic value, but these stamps seemingly made them more rare. Sylvia joked with me here, saying that I would need to pay her again later on. That instant, I got a WhatsApp message from a local historian who said that the Western Telegraph Company had another station on this island. It was in Olho da Água. Sylvia and I are looking at the old photo the local historian sent me, dated 1922. A large square mansion with tons of windows sits in the middle of the Brazilian jungle. Sylvia recognized it.
Mas agora, no mesmo lugar, é uma clínica.
Qual é a clínica? Ah, Bargeri.
Exatamente. Então, esse livro...
antes foi um hotel.
Hotel?
Antes da clínica, se não me engano.
So she said that this was Clínica La Ravageri, a mental health clinic that currently has the old Western Telegraph building on their property. She said that this building possibly could have been a hotel in the 1960s. Both of the Kipling books mention Olho da Água, handwritten by Serby in the Land and Sea Tales book, and on the stamp in the Rewards and Fairies novel. We had finally found their respective libraries. I'm headed to this clinic with my friend Rebecca. The managers of Clínica La Ravageri agreed to give me a tour of their grounds, which has the once functioning Olho da Água Western Telegraph Station, sometimes referred to as the ODA Observatory.
Okay. Yeah. It's way bigger than I thought. Aqui. Olá, boa tarde. Tá. Você é Joana?
Joana.
Tá, chefe. Muito prazer. Tá.
I met with Joanna, one of the on-site managers, when we stepped outside. We entered the gates into a courtyard with hundreds of mental patients playing games and talking on their outdoor break. We waited for Ronald, who had the keys to let us in on the other side of the campus. Built in the 1980s, their medical buildings seem very different from the one we were about to see. And finally, we rounded a corner and stood in front of the observatory.
Wow.
A large, untouched, European-looking mansion. It's the one from the photos, the place that housed these books. We're actually standing in the exact location where the other photos were taken, in front of a tiny church built later. She leads us to a plaque on the bottom right corner of the building. It was an engraved tile with the civil engineer's name, Gaspare Cornagiani, in its years of completion, 1920 to 22. This observatory garnered some attention in San Luis during its construction because of its architectural feat, a massive station built for 150 workers, most of whom were not Brazilian.
Então agora esse prédio está usado, você usa
para... É utilizado.
Tá, utilizado.
Agora sim, a gente, como eu te falei, eu não consigo levar vocês lá.
So they are currently using this building for the most volatile patients, and we couldn't go inside. Nonetheless, I took some pictures holding the Kipling books in my hands in front of the observatory. I essentially returned two British library books back to their original location 100 years later.
É, exatamente, essa coisa. Porque eu preciso de devolver o livro para a biblioteca. 100 anos no futuro. Essa coisa estranha.
I may have located the place where the books were shelved and cataloged, but I haven't found the man who originally signed it, or those who possibly know where it came from.
A moça que veio aqui, que era canadense,
Ronald tells me about a daughter of a man who worked for the Western Telegraph Company at this Olho da Água location. She was also investigating this building and the Western Telegraph Company. In 1957, this building was sold to a Brazilian couple. For the next 30 years, we have no idea what was done to it. Maybe a hotel or a shipping business. The health clinic bought this large land in the 1980s and the Olho da Água station. It apparently still had some objects inside from the Western Telegraph days. One of these owners sold the Western Telegraph Company books to different collectors, including Bernardo Tajada, the cinema owner with his extensive book collection.
Muito, muito
obrigado.
Tchau. Tchau, tchau.
We left the health clinic and said goodbye to Joanna and Ronald. It was truly an honor to be there, face to face with a building I didn't even think would be real.
You know when you do something and you go, okay, I have more questions. That's where I'm at now.
These Kipling books have been passed through a lot of hands. A telegraph company to a Brazilian couple, then to a cinema owner, two secondhand book collectors, and finally in my lap. Who was the first set of hands to sign it and put it in this library?
And, you know, the staff rotated because you could take that for a few months, okay?
Here is Bill Burns again.
And then you got paid leave with all your transport paid back to England for a month or more. And then you were back out to the cable station for 6 months, okay? So I'm sure the staff coming in would bring books with them, just to read on the voyage. And then they put them in the library.
This theory made the most sense because after months of research, that Serby name checked out. In the book, it reads A.W. Serby. Archibald William Serby. I had the signature verified by his granddaughter on Facebook. She also corroborated that he was a banker in South America, but wasn't sure how it was linked to the Western Telegraph Company.
So this is, you know, the puzzle about your Western Telegraph Company library. You've got these pictures of the building. Now, was that the main cable building with everything in it? It's too big to be just a library. So they would never put that kind of money. And you're lucky if you got a set of shelves for one room, and that was your library funding.
Mr. Burns is talking about the pictures I sent of the Olho da Água Observatory in the second stamp I found in Heba's book.
On the very bottom, there's a blue stamp that says the WTC Mess Library, and then it says Olho da Água, which is that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So
the mess would have been the dining facility, of course.
So the observatory I just visited had two libraries, one in a mess hall and the other near an office or in a sleeping quarter. It would make sense that this banker, Archibald Serby, would have donated this book while visiting this outpost one day. Serby's name only showed up in one other archive, on a European island in between France and England.
The Jersey archive, which is not part of the UK, by the way, It's under British protection, I guess, but it's an independent entity.
So the Jersey Heritage Archives are in the island of Jersey, a self-governing dependency of the United Kingdom in the Channel Islands. Two telegraph engineers who worked in Brazil wrote a newsletter for the workers called the Olho da Água Observer, including poems, drawings, and sports announcements. There were even photos of the workers in the observatory in 1926. Serby is mentioned twice in this newsletter. The most important reference was that he lived in the city center of San Luis with his wife, possibly close to that other Western Telegraph office with the clock. A Serby family member told me that I should talk to Archie Serby. He is the grandson of Archibald Sr., the Kipling reader and banker.
So I am Archie Serby. I am the grandson of Mr. Archibald Serby. I'm not Archibald. In Brazil, Archibald would be a difficult name to spell. So my parents just called me Archie.
Archie was born in Brazil, just like his father, James, in 1948. James was the oldest child of Archibald Sr., our man in question.
In Fortaleza, my father was born. He was born in 1917. And a year or two later, my aunt was born also in Fortaleza.
So Archibald Sr. and Mary Wilson had four children, born in different cities across Brazil. James, Archie's dad, his aunt Leonora, another Archie, and finally John. Out of all of these descendants, James's and Leonora's kids know the most about the family history, especially in correlation to his job.
I know that he came to Brazil as an expat for Lloyd's Bank just after the First World War, was posted to Salvador in Bahia, where he met my grandmother.
So just to clarify, Lloyd's Bank combined two South American-based British banks in the early 20th century. the London and River Plate Bank and the London and Brazilian Bank merged into the Bank of London and South America, known as Bolsa, in 1923. The records for these companies today are in the Lloyds Banking Group archives in London, but a researcher there told me that Serby's name did not come up. What we do know is that in every boat passenger list that Archibald Serby signed, he wrote that he was an accountant or banker. One of them states that he worked for the Bank of London in South America in 1924, the same year he signed this book. Nonetheless, it was a nomadic job, because you had to help different companies' finances wherever they were located. So he was posted in a lot of cities: Salvador, Fortaleza, San Luis, and Espírito Santo. Archie had mentioned that his grandfather lived in the historic center in San Luis. One of the ways we know this is because he actually went there and tried to find it.
She showed me some photos of the house in San Luis in an album she had with her in England. And on one of my holiday trips in the early 70s, I went to San Luis and I found the house. The house still was there. It's near the center, near the palace. And then I talked to my grandmother and she confirmed that that was the house.
I pressed Archie for that photo, or if he remembered which street their house was on. He couldn't find the picture or recall where exactly.
You have to create a story from there.
Right.
As I told you before, I'll answer in my capacity. I have no documentation at all except my memories.
Having been 50 years since he last saw this house, it doesn't surprise me that time has obscured the finer details. Before Archie's father was moved to San Luis, he was stationed in Salvador, Bahia. Archibald Sr. got lucky to be placed in Salvador first, because that's where he met Mary Wilson, a Brazilian with Scottish parents.
My grandmother was the daughter of one of, 9 or 10. My grandmother was a red-headed Scottish, hot-hearted person. They met in Salvador. She said, I'm going to marry this man. She married Mr. Archibald Searby.
Mary Wilson, Archie's grandmother, actually plays a huge part in this story, because although Archie did meet his grandfather, it was the closeness to Mary that he remembered fondly.
My contact was mostly with my grandmother. So I wrote to my granny, and that's the way we maintained contact. She was always very talky. She loved to talk. She loved to tell stories and so on. Whilst my grandfather was a very quiet person.
Can you just tell me about who he was, what he was like, Mr. Serby, and what it was like living with him?
Well, I remember him sitting in the sitting room and smoking his pipe. That's the kind of memory I have of my grandfather. He would sit in the sitting room, read a book, put on his pipe, and we would talk, but very little really. Then he would sleep, and the pipe would fall out of his mouth and onto his chest and start burning. Contact with my grandfather was not the same as with my grandmother. So I was nearly 10 years old, 9 to 10 years old, when I went to England to study in the south of England in a school called Montpellier School. So what happened was that during my holidays, the longer holidays, I would go by train to London and from London to Louth, where my grandfather's lived. So I saw them about a few weeks or months during every year.
Archie doesn't remember any of the books his grandfather read, but he does remember his dad buying the Jungle book set. Archie's cousin, Joy, told me that she had many Kipling books too, some of which Archibald Sr. got for his grandkids. Joy remembers the Western Telegraph Company and Olho da Água from Mary, but Archie doesn't.
And I don't remember when my grandfather left Lloyd's Bank to go to the Western Telegraph. I don't know when he did that. I always thought he was at Lloyd's Bank all the time.
Well, he was. The Bank of London and South America had different bankers help them with international transactions starting out as accountants. Archibald Sr. worked as a banker from 1910 until the 1930s, when he later became a manager. Archibald and Mary lived in San Luis for only a couple of years, and I wonder if Archibald Sr. signed more books that he donated to the Western Telegraph Library in Olitaagua.
If you wish, you return it to the library.
Right.
I told Archie what was in the Jersey archives. There was another mention of Archibald Serby playing lawn tennis with other workers.
So I know you saw him at a very different time of his life, but is that something you would expect him to be doing in the 1920s? Would it be playing tennis as a bank accountant?
He never told me about that. As I said, when I met him, he was already an older person. He would bowling, but he wouldn't do tennis. He would have passed it on to his sons. My father was a cricketer. My father played a lot of cricket. Cricket was something they would play a lot.
In the grassy area surrounding the Olitaagua Observatory, they created their own rec center with a soccer field, lawn tennis, swimming pool, and even ping pong. Later, they would create soccer teams and play local companies. There was one last connection to Kipling I thought about. And this theory starts with Archibald Sr.'s third child, also named Archie.
The third brother, which is Archie, he was named after my grandfather. I was named after both of them. Archie was born in San Luis. He was the third. Unluckily, Archie died in the middle of the war, flying over Germany. His body was never recovered. He flew on a bombing and never came back. He was a very young guy. He was about 18 or 19.
This same thing happened to the author Rudyard Kipling, who sent his young son to fight for the British in World War I and was killed in battle. Similarly, his body was never found either. Archie, the 19-year-old cadet killed in 1942, was born in San Luis Marañón. This Kipling novel is signed a year after Archibald's son is born in a book where the author's child had a similar fate. In the end, though, Archie holds on to those good memories of who his grandfather really was.
One of the things I knew about my grandfather, he was one of the most patient persons I could imagine. I never heard him lift his voice at all. He was patient with everything. And he would love to potter there in the greenhouse. He would love to walk, especially we would walk with Nicky, the dog, but on a very patient and a very calm way. He was the calmest person I could ever imagine. My grandfather died a few years later, but I remember getting things in order there and burying my grandfather.
Archibald Serby passed away in 1962 from a stroke at 76 years of age.
I really love to return these objects back to the families after I find them. So I don't know if anyone in the family would like this Rudyard Kipling book back with his signature.
Well, Thatcher, I think if you can make better use of the book, you use it.
Perfect.
But I think you can make better use of the book and part of your work. For me, it would be just an object was once belonging to my grandfather.
After 8 months researching this story, I have passed by many books, each with their own stories and their own readers. No matter how many hands an object passes through, you can still find its first owner, even if you have to go to the strangest and yet most welcoming places. So we can close the pages of this chapter in this winding story about a banker with a book in Brazil. The next time you're at a secondhand bookstore, what will you find? Thank you for joining us on another Object Obscura journey, where every object has a story. This was a production of the Obscurity Podcast Network. Just a listener note that we still do not have a picture of Mr. Archibald W. Serby. There are some pictures of the Western Telegraph staff at Olho d'Água, but I haven't been able to verify if he is in this picture. So if you are a family member or a friend of the Serbys, please feel free to reach out to us on our Instagram at object.obscura and our email Thatcher, T-H-A-T-C-H-E-R, at object-obscura.com. Thank you to Silvia Giniz and her secondhand bookstore, Passo Prosa Livraria. You can follow her on Instagram at Passo Prosa, and you can see her store in Heavyver San Luis if you ever visit in the northeast of Brazil. Thank you to Bill Burns for sharing your expertise about telegraphy. Please go to his fantastic website, Atlantic-Cable.com. There is a blog about our episode that you can read as well. Thank you to Tatiani, Joanna, and Holnauch from the Clinica La Javagieri in Olho d'Água for the tour of the campus and information regarding the acquisition of the building. Finally, thank you to Joy Inch and Archie Serby for your patience and helping me understand the life of Archibald W. Serby and your family stories. This episode was written and translated by me, Ben Hess, Cylon Souza, and Aliani Miranda. This episode was edited and fact-checked by me and Aliani Miranda. Special thanks to the Fulbright ETA scholarship. Additional thanks to Tony Walstenholm and Harry Lefebvre at the Jersey Heritage Archives, Alan Renton from the PK Porthcurno Archives, Peter Judge and Karen Sampson at the Lloyd Group Banking Archives, Evie Stevenson, Vilma Teixeira de Costas at the Arquivo Público do Maranhão, Cida Macedo, Paulo Victor Galvão, Rebeca Alencar, Apoliana Santos, Melina Martins, Kiba from Sebo Livros e Discos, Nildo from the Court Building of Maranhão, Ricardo Costa, Flavimiro Mendonça, Rosa Machado, and the staff of the Biblioteca Pública Benedito Leite. This podcast was distributed by Spotify for Podcasters. The theme song is Bateria Brasileira by Redemon. All other song and archival credits are in the description. So please go to Apple Podcasts to rate our show. You just select the number of stars and you can write any comment you desire. There is now a way to support us. There is a PayPal donation button on our website, object-obscura.com. I couldn't make the show in Brazil without your support. So thank you for what you feel like we deserve. Want to reach out to us? Well, send us a message on Facebook at Object Obscura Podcast, on Instagram at object.obscura, and Twitter at Object Obscura. It can be about an object you want me to research for an episode of this show, or about anything antiques related. I will post all of the pictures of this episode's object and the people you heard voices from on each platform. The last episode of this season comes out in 2 weeks, on April 28th.
So, looks like we're gonna go to this old building in the middle of the jungle by boat.
See you then.